Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Nick Hornby, whose latest novel is Slam. Earlier novels include A Long Way Down, How to Be Good, High Fidelity, About a Boy. Nick Hornby is also the author of a memoir, Fever Pitch. Nick Hornby, the latest novel, Slam, is ostensibly a young adult novel, though of course it reads like all of your other books, and it's about teen pregnancy. What prompted you to write this book?
I still don't know whether it is a young adult book. I saw a young couple in my neighborhood pushing a stroller around, and I thought, well, I kind of know her story because there's a lot written about teen mums, but I don't know much about his story. So I started to think about that character. But as you say, it doesn't feel like a departure beyond that the protagonist is 16.
In writing the book, you've said in a blog that one thing authors don't ask you about is the thousands of tiny decisions that go into writing a novel.
No, I'm going to be hoist by my own petard.
It's actually a question that I frequently ask because I'm fascinated by it. Writing is really puzzle solving, trying to get from point A to point B in such a way so that you don't look like a puppeteer and that the characters are real. Would you say that's pretty accurate?
I'd say that's definitely a big part of it. I think that the thing that people tend to ask about, which is inspiration, if there is any kind of rush of inspiration, it happens way before you begin writing a book. And then after that, yeah, it's kind of shuffling stuff around and fitting stuff in. And I think people would be amazed at how often in a working day something breaks down because you can't figure a way of conjoining two sentences, not because you don't know what's going to happen next or you don't know what this book is about, but the actual technical issue of writing is quite often the hardest.
Doesn't it get easier if you have a real firm grasp of the voice?
Oh, no, absolutely. You know, that's something that I spend a long time with before I start writing. But even so, that, as you say, the conveying of information in a way that doesn't sound clunky, all of these little things add up.
The character, main character of Slam is a 15, then 16-year-old boy by the name of Sam. How easy or hard was it to get that voice down?
Well, it was hard in the way that writing books is hard. My last novel, A Long Way Down, I had 4 voices in that. Just because the protagonist is in his mid-teens, it didn't make it any harder or indeed any easier, me having been a mid-teen once.
When you've got that in your head, at what point do you begin thinking about the other characters and his relation to them? How does a plot emerge? I mean, Slam is, in a way, a little more plot-heavy, say, than A Long Way Down, which is more or less follows these 4 people after they choose to commit suicide. How do you assemble that together? Does it come piecemeal? Does it come in the writing? Is it there beforehand?
Well, a lot of the minor characters in Slam, obviously, Slam is related to by kind of definition of who he is. So I think that things like that, I tend to know a lot about a person before I start writing about him. And even with the characters in A Long Way Down, even though their parents wouldn't necessarily appear, I'd like to feel that I knew where they come from, how they grew up. So with Sam, I had his mother and father, his girlfriend, then ex-girlfriend, and him. And pretty much everyone else comes up, I guess, during the writing.
He has an imaginary conversation with a real person by the name of Tony Hawk, who's a skateboarder. First, are the lines from Hawk's autobiography that are quoted in your book, those are real, right?
Those are real, yeah.
Do you know Tony Hawk?
We've been conversing by email a bit recently, but I don't know him. I emailed him. When I had the idea for the book, I got an email address and wrote to him to ask his permission, because obviously if he said no, there'd be a bit of a hole where a book should be. And he's been really gracious and encouraging.
What made you decide to make Sam a skateboarder?
You know, originally I thought he was going to be talking to a soccer player, which is something I know about. But when I thought about it, I wanted more of a private conversation. And football is so ubiquitous in the UK and so kind of corporate and Nike-ized that it didn't seem right for this kid. So I wanted to choose something which was, I guess, younger, and there'd be a dissonance between his hobby and what was happening to him in his life.
And the choice of making his mother very young and father, of course, was part of the actual story. That would have been there from the beginning.
Yeah, this idea that he's kind of cursed and just carrying on the family teen pregnancy line was something that I wanted to do.
It's very difficult when you're writing from a teen's perspective when the mother and father are so much younger than the author.
Yeah, I that was kind of the thing that was almost freakiest when I was writing the book. It's one thing to imagine this 16-year-old boy, but to think that a 32-year-old woman has a 16-year-old boy was very hard to deal with. I was 35 before I became a father.
The other part of it is that the father is younger in some respects by the end of the book than the son.
Yeah, the way it's set up in the book is that the mother has kind of worked very hard to move on, and she took qualifications, and she is a different person by the time Sam is in his mid-teens. But Sam's dad is kind of stuck where he was when he had him in the first place.
This brings up an interesting point, which is that a lot of your books about a boy, for instance, High Fidelity, these books all concern people having to grow up. And I guess A Long Way Down also does, but in a somewhat different way. This seems to be running through your book. How do you become an adult?
For me, I think of it more as, what do you do as an adult when there is no necessary compulsion to be like an adult? I mean, when I'm asked this question, it seems to presuppose that an adult is someone who puts on a jacket and tie in the morning and starts work at 9 o'clock. And, you know, the world's a very different place now. So I'm writing about trying to be adult in that environment, I think.
There's also a magic realist or science fiction element to the book. Was that always intended? Did that just crop up out of the blue?
It was sort of always intended. One of the things I wanted to write about was how things feel on the inside compared to how they look on the outside. And this came out of a conversation I was having with a mother who said that all these young women come up to her and say, but doesn't being a mum wreck your life? Doesn't it stop you from doing this and that and the other? And she said, well, all I can say to them is, yes, of course it does, but I can never convey why it feels worth it. And one of the things I wanted to get across was, for Sam, he feels competent and connected once he's had the kid. But these three flash forwards, he's occupying his own skin, but he doesn't have the skills to do it, nor does he have the relationship with the child. Plus, for me, it was funny that he doesn't know what he's doing in his own life. So he's got to try and piece this together quickly in these episodes.
But when he actually lives it, he's not under the compulsion to live everything in the same way. He just wakes up and goes, aha, this is the day.
Yes, but he's kind of grown into his own skin, and he is competent, and he does have the relationship with the child. And it enables him to step up to the plate in a way he didn't think he was going to be able to.
In terms of charting out his life, how far charted out was it when you sat down and wrote the book? How much of the book was already in your head?
I think pretty much every book that I've written, I've had big landmark pieces that I know about, like, you know, maybe a beginning and a middle and tonally at least the end. Everything else tends to come up during the writing. I'm kind of working my way towards these staging posts. And I tend to write in set pieces. One set piece is loosely linked to the one that came before. I mean, my brother-in-law, for example, is a thriller writer, and he has to have everything incredibly tightly plotted out. He can't mess about the way that I mess about. But for me, it's part of the fun.
Did you do much research in trying to find out what kids are thinking and doing these days? Was that an issue for you at all?
No, that wasn't an issue for me. I had to do research in terms of things like skateboarding and stuff like that. But I take the view with pretty much all of the books that people are people, and they respond in a way that is kind of logical to situations.
The voices in your books are very specific voices. You're putting yourself into people's heads. You're not writing from the perspective of an omnipresent, omniscient narrator. Is there a reason for that?
Well, it was something that I found I could do, I think. When I started to write, I didn't think I'd be able to write prose at all, and I was trying to write screenplays because I thought, well, I think I might be able to do the dialogue, but I'm not sure I can do the linking stuff. It comes out of that. I think that what I write is more like extended monologues than novels, and I have to physically be able to hear the voice before I start. So I have this conversational tone, and I find it easier to be right in there with the people.
Do you read it aloud to yourself?
I don't read it aloud, but that's essentially the process. I mean, I'm kind of reading it aloud internally, as it were. But it doesn't feel like writing. It feels like speaking.
You said that, in particular, a long way down was when you specifically looked and said, I am going to make these speaking voices.
Yeah, I'd written a short story a couple of years before for a collection called Speaking with the Angel, and I'd asked all the contributors to write monologues, I mean, specifically. And when I did mine, I thought, oh, I see, this is kind of what I do anyway, but I've never owned up to it.
Nick Hornby, let's talk a little about your career. Your first book was Fever Pitch, and at that point, had you done much writing growing up?
Not particularly. I was one of those people that thought of himself as a writer without actually doing any writing. And round about my mid-20s, I started to realize that no one was going to give me a call and ask me to be a writer. They had to see something first. So thus began the long process of, well, writing these sort of terrible screenplay things that got rejected. A big breakthrough for me was switching to prose and mostly first person. I sold a couple of short stories to the BBC, and that encouraged me to work in that kind of vein. And Fever Pitch was my first full-length book, which, of course, wasn't fiction, but somebody expressed an interest in that, so that's what I wrote first.
You mentioned to someone you wanted to write about your fanaticism as a sports, as an Arsenal fan, right?
A friend who was a writer, his agent was at a party, and she was being nice and talking to me and said, you know, what did I want to do? And I said this was one of the things I wanted to do, and she was incredibly encouraging about it.
You wrote the book, and it became a success and became a film shortly thereafter with Colin Firth.
Yeah.
You, I would guess, have been a fan of British football since you were a kid, right?
Yeah, I started going when I was 11.
What is Arsenal?
Arsenal's one of the, what we call the big four professional football clubs in England. They weren't as successful as they are at the moment. When I wrote the book in 1992, they'd won a couple of championships in sort of 30 or 40 years. They're a North London club. I go every game.
And the four clubs, Manchester United, is that
one of them? Liverpool is another. And now Chelsea, because this Russian oligarch bought them and bought anything that they wanted.
So you grew up pretty much rooting for a team the equivalent of the Boston Red Sox or the Chicago Cubs.
Yeah, except Arsenal had won everything in the 1930s, and I started going in the 1960s, and they'd won nothing since.
At some point, you were approached by American producers?
I wasn't ever approached, because once I'd sold the movie rights for Fever Pitch, they were no longer mine. But it was a movie producer that I knew who approached the British company for the rights.
How did you feel about the transplanting of the story to America, to the Boston Red Sox, and the final result of the film?
I know that American people are sports fanatics. They have the same relationships with their baseball clubs or their football clubs as I have with mine, but they couldn't understand the sport. So in some ways it made a lot of sense, I think, to transpose that idea of focusing on the relationship. And the Red Sox seemed a pretty good choice. And there was this amazing thing that while they were making the movie, the Red Sox won the World Series, which was entirely, of course, unanticipated. I've been told by a lot of Americans that now rooting for the Red Sox is like rooting for the Yankees or Manchester United. In other words, you're siding with the rich and powerful against the underdog, which is never a very comfortable position.
Nick Hornby, after that you wrote your first novel, which was High Fidelity.
Well, weirdly, the record store aspect of that book was the thing that came up last. I really wanted to write about the history of a relationship from a guy's point of view. I was a big fan of, and still am a big fan of, people like Anne Tyler and Laurie Moore, and that kind of detailed domesticity with kind of soul and humor. And I thought, well, men never write these books. I want to write one of these books. So it was only right at the end, when I was kind of scouting around for a job for him, I thought, oh, you know, I know about music. I'm making work in a record store.
Again, that became a film set in Chicago.
Mm.
And once again, you had no problem with the transformation?
No, absolutely no problem at all. First of all, I'd come here to tour with the book, and nobody ever said to me, oh, that's what life's like in England. They always said, you know, my brother's like this, or my boyfriend's like that, or I'm like that. So I could see that this was a book not about living in London, but about living in a modern first world city.
And then after that, you began receiving emails from someone who was working on a musical.
Yeah, a lovely woman called Amanda Green, who wrote the lyrics for this musical of High Fidelity that came out at the end of last year and then sadly disappeared straight away.
You got to see it. What did you think of it?
I loved it. It's interesting. Everyone I went with thought it was great, and they were all kind of dreading it and dubious about it. I'm still not quite sure why it was a Broadway show rather than an off-Broadway show. One of the things that I think went wrong with the production is that these characters are basically insulting the tastes of the audience in the theatre, because those are the people who have got $150 to spend on a Broadway seat. Whereas, of course, the movie, you go along and you're paying your $10 and you are one of those guys. And that was, I think, absolutely why it didn't work, because even the movie, it wasn't a big movie, it was a culty movie. It's not going to get people in on the name alone. So my own hunch now is that they should have started smaller.
Well, how do you feel about the translation? About a Boy was also translated. How do you feel about the idea of taking your work, kind of giving it to someone else and seeing what they'll do with it?
I'm completely cool about it, because it doesn't feel as though it's the book that's becoming something else. The book is the book and it's finished. And if someone else wants to read it and convert it into their medium, then I'm completely fine with that. It's kind of really interesting if people want to do musicals or graphic novels or movies or whatever it is they want to do. All it means for me is I get to meet smart, talented, enthusiastic people who want to give me some money.
Long Way Down was purchased by Johnny Depp.
Yeah, his production company, yeah. The screenplay has been written, or a draft of a screenplay has been written, by my friend D.V. De Vicentis, who also adapted High Fidelity. But, you know, movies are such a kind of perilous course. Things collapse every day and then become resuscitated and then collapse again. At the moment, as we speak, I think the whole of Hollywood is obsessed by a writers and actors strike that's coming up. And if things aren't ready to go now, then they're not very interested. I think that it'll go into hibernation for a few months, this project, and maybe come out again afterwards.
What about a film called An Education? What's that about?
Oh, this is an adaptation of someone else's work, in fact. This is something I've been working on for the last 2 or 3 years. It's a small piece of memoir, an essay that an English journalist wrote about an affair she had when she was 16 at the beginning of the 1960s. I really kind of took to it in ways that I can't quite fathom, but it felt like something that I wanted to adapt. So at the moment, that's scheduled to shoot in January with the Danish director, Lone Scherfig, and Peter Sarsgaard starring in it. He'll be playing English for the first time. But again, who knows? Tomorrow, maybe not.
Is the director one of those Dogma directors?
She's been associated with Dogma, yes, yeah.
Nick Hornby, you've also got a book called Speaking with the Angel. Your son's autistic.
Well, I got 3 sons, and my eldest one, the 14-year-old, is autistic.
Yeah. How did you find that out?
He's quite profoundly autistic, so you didn't really have to have a diagnosis after a while. Eventually, obviously, we got one, but we were pretty sure that that was what the problem was.
How did you get involved in the world of autism? It just happened?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard not to get involved in the world of autism. And I think if you have some kind of public profile, the decision not to speak publicly would have been much harder than the decision to speak publicly, if you see what I mean.
How has he moved through his autism at this point?
I mean, it's been a big thing that a group of parents set up a school in 1997, so we've just had our 10th anniversary. And he was one of the first 5 kids that went there. And this school, Treehouse, has since grown and grown and grown. And we've now got our own land, and we're building our own purpose-built school, and there are 60 kids there. And we've nearly finished the fundraising for the school, but we've still got a bit of a ways to go. And the big thing that's happened to him is that he's much, much happier, and he's a pretty social kid now. He doesn't get fazed by very much. And he's got 2 little brothers whose company he actively seems to enjoy, which again was unimaginable a few years ago.
At this particular time, if a stranger were to meet him, would they even suspect he's autistic?
Yeah, because of the stereotypical autistic behavior. So he'd very likely let out some kind of wild whoop. And, you know, he doesn't speak. There's that as well. He's nonverbal.
Speaking with the Angel is 12 short stories. Are they specifically about autism?
No, absolutely not. I asked friends of mine who were writers and mostly well-known writers who I thought could make the school some money to write a first-person piece that might be able to be used as a monologue.
And the polysyllabic spree proceeds for that are also going to Treehouse, right?
Yeah, there are two collections, actually, the polysyllabic spree and another one called Housekeeping Versus the Dirt. I think the first one we're splitting between the 826 school here in San Francisco and Treehouse.
And the polysyllabic spree is based on a column that you wrote for a couple of years about
your reading.
Yeah. Oh, you're still writing it?
Yeah.
How do you feel about writing the column after all this time? It's about the books you've read, kind of reviews about them.
I enjoy it. I enjoy doing it. I mean, one of the things is I think when you write novels, there's no product for a year or 18 months or something. And it's really nice to feel that I've accomplished something in a month that appears in this very beautiful magazine, The Believer. But also, I think it's important that someone at least writes something about books that isn't a review. So it's more about the process and experience of reading. I'm not paid to read any of these books. These are the books that I decided to pick up and maybe put down, and why I picked them up and put them down.
How much do you think reading is the author, and how much do you think it's the reader?
I think that it's a relationship. I know that there are some books I've read badly, and it wasn't the author's fault. My concentration was bad. I was tired. I was reading the book at a time in my life where I didn't have enough time to devote chunks of time. I don't think a book necessarily stands a chance in those circumstances.
A Long Way Down got a lot of attention because it starts out being about four people who want to commit suicide.
Mm.
What was the origin of those opening segments of the book?
Well, I live near a bridge in North London that a lot of people jump from. I kind of go over it or under it quite a few times during the course of the year, and it's impossible not to go there without thinking about suicide. But what made me think about the book was something I heard on the radio about suicide rates spiking on certain nights of the year, so Valentine's and New Year's and so on. And so the next time I went under that bridge, I thought, does that mean maybe on New Year's Eve you might bump into someone? And certainly there are, you know, other suicide spots all around the UK and the world where I'm sure that that must be possible. So I just started to imagine what this relationship might be and whether it would alter the outcome.
The four characters, one of them is Martin, who is a celebrity who's been through a bit of a bad stretch. This was a comment on the celebrity culture and what it does to people.
Yeah, and especially I think in the UK, we don't have a movie star level of celebrity. So we tend to create our own celebrities an awful lot. There's a lot of reality TV stars who are as kind of big as anything and then disappear just as quickly. I think it's possible to be destroyed. Our tabloid press is very different as well, in that people read tabloid papers instead of newspapers in the UK.
Well, I think with the advent of Rupert Murdoch coming to America, that's changed here now.
Yeah, I think it's changed since I first started touring in the US, yeah.
You know, when I look at people like Paris Hilton or Lindsay Lohan, I'm not seeing much difference between that and, say, what Martin experiences.
No, and I think that is new, that kind of celebrity in the US. You used to have proper stars. I think that one of the things that interested me about Martin is that he has no real talent, without going into who's got talent and who hasn't
right.
got talent in the US. There are people. I mean, Paris Hilton has no discernible talent. I think she'd be the first, possibly, well, maybe the last to admit that. But, but you know, she's not a singer or a movie star. She is famous for being famous. And that means that you have to carry on being famous. Otherwise, you have no job. And that's a very, very dangerous environment, I think. Even my own experience of minor, very minor celebrity in the UK has been uncomfortable on occasions because, you know, if you buy a house, then it gets in a newspaper. If you get divorced, as I did, it gets in the newspaper. And I never felt like I was going to live this kind of life when my ambition was to write a book.
How do you deal with whatever celebrity you have, the fact that you are a, quote, cult writer?
I don't think it needs dealing with. There are things like this, there are interviews and book tours and so on, and I've got used to the idea that people, bless them, want to sit in a room and hear me read sometimes. But the rest of my life is family, working on my own in a room. I mean, it's kind of as far away from celebrity as you can imagine, I think, being a writer.
There's another character in A Long Way Down, JJ, and I read on Wikipedia that he's supposed to be inspired by a member of a band that you work with. Is that true, though?
I'm not sure that he was inspired by him, but there was a point where I was in the middle of this book, and I think this is turning into this character. What I was trying to do was write about myself when I was aged 30, which was I wasn't getting anything published. I was beginning to become increasingly worried about what I was going to do with my life, and I was quite depressed. Well, I didn't want to do it about a writer. I know, again, something about music, and I'm going to make it a musician. And then I wanted it to be a certain kind of music that no longer perhaps is striking the same chord with young people, a kind of roots rock. And I wanted this guy to be smart and to read. And when I had all these things written down, I thought, uh-oh, that might be recognizable to this guy. But that's kind of how characters work, I think, that rather than look at someone out in life and bring them into the book, you try and make them as real as possible and look around to see if there are any counterparts. When I got to this stage, of course, I said to him, look, this guy is turning into you, and I want you to read it and see if there's anything that bugs you. But he was cool about it.
Well, Nick Hornby, what about in Slam? Has Sam turned into anyone?
Well, Sam very much started as myself, aged 16, in that my teenage years, I think, were not so dissimilar to the teenage years of a lot of kids now. Of course, if you're going to write about this thing, this huge thing that happens to this kid, you start with thinking, Jesus, what would I have done, aged 16, if my girlfriend had told me I was pregnant? It's not the narrative, what would I have done, that you're interested in. It's the emotional part of that, and that was very useful to me.
Getting back to something we talked about at the beginning, in terms of thousands of tiny decisions, okay, putting aside the writing decision, getting from one sentence to the other, the decisions to, say, have the baby named a certain thing, okay, those kinds of decisions, how do they come up for you? Do they just spontaneously?
Yes. The thing about the baby was absolutely spontaneous, that I wanted this scene in the book where, first of all, Sam doesn't know the name of his kid. And then I thought, well, let's see if we can do this, take this one stage further. Let's have it that when he does hear the name of his kid, he doesn't know what the hell that name is. And the kid is called Roof in the book, R-O-O-F. That was the first thing, was just kind of to pluck a sound out of the air and see what you can work with. And obviously I had three or four variations on that, but I thought, well, if you have R-O-O-F, and then it turns out that the kid's name is Rufus, that kind of makes sense. And then there is a scene when the baby is born that explains why the baby is called Rufus.
So you had no idea about the explanation when he was just named
No,
Rufus?
No, absolutely not. I just wanted a kind of scrappy one-syllable sound that then I would have to come up with the explanation for.
Is this pretty common? Did you have moments like that in A Long Way Down where you set up something but you have no idea what you're setting up and then somehow serendipitously it happens?
Well, I can give you one example of that from About a Boy, in fact. There's a scene in About a Boy where Will buys Marcus some trainers, sneakers, whatever, and he gets them stolen. He turns up at Will's house in kind of bare feet. And what happened there was, when I started writing this scene of Will buying the kids some trainers, it was kind of inevitable in the book that this had to happen. But there is a scene in Ann Tyler's The Accidental Tourist where Macon Leary buys this kid who is not his own some clothes. As I was writing this scene, I thought, oh, God, this is turning into that scene from The Accidental Tourist. I'd better do something quick. and so that kind of creation of narrative was caused by the fear of turning it into something else. My songbook was called 31 Songs in the UK, but is it Dayville's that has 31 flavours? Vic Sweeney's didn't want any reference to Dayville's in the publication that came out here.
Speaking of that, what is Songbook?
Songbook is a collection of essays about favourite songs, basically. But, again, it's like a little bit like Fever Pitch. It's about the relationship between me and the song rather than the song itself.
What I found is that I reached a certain point and I felt like I could no longer keep up at all with pop music, and I gave up on it. It just, like, kept changing too fast. How do you deal with that?
Well, I think pop music's interesting in that we are all growing old within it. And the Dylans and the Jaggers are kind of leading the way, and I'm in the, I guess, the next generation on. People are very keen to recommend things to me, partly because of High Fidelity. I think there's a lot of music that's meant for me, and there are magazines, I guess, like Mojo in the UK, which is for a kind of older rock and roll reader. People make me CDs, all sorts, and I find music all the time, but I want to listen to new music. It's important to me.
Well, what new bands would you recommend right now?
I've been listening to a couple of singer-songwriters these last few weeks. I think that the new Josh Ritter album is lovely, and also another Josh Rouse. And I don't listen to very much hip-hop, but I've been listening to this young woman from the UK, Sri Lankan woman called M.I.A. I think her album's extraordinary.
Nick Hornby, you've written Slam. Now, you've said that until you finish your book tours, you don't start on another book. Mm-hmm. Is that the case here, too?
Yeah, and I've got some rewrites to do on an education if it's going to be made in January, so that'll be my next job. But I know what my next book's going to be. I'll tell you why I don't talk about it. It's not through any kind of juju reasons or anything like that. My novels are so underplotted, as you've made reference to before, that when I try to give people the gist of an idea, they look so sorry for me that I get terribly depressed. I mean, you can imagine, perhaps, when I was writing High Fidelity and I said it was about a guy who works in a record store who splits up with his girlfriend, the look of pity in people's eyes made it very hard for me to get back to work the next day. So I just keep it to myself so that they can imagine at least it might be something good.
There's a collaboration that you've been working on with a rock band, Marah. Do you read essays and then they play songs? How does that work?
Yeah, it's a show that we've kind of designed just because we have fun working together. My essays, I guess, are a kind of sidetracked out of songbook in that they're about live shows that I've seen. So it's the history of my relationship with live music. And they play kind of a cover after each of these essays. And the last essay is about them. And then off they go and they play their show.
Where has this been performed?
We've done it all over, several cities in Europe, London, Chicago, Philadelphia, and New York. We haven't done it for a while, but I'm always keen to resuscitate it.
Nick Hornby, one final question. Slam, any idea about a movie there?
I've been approached. It's not something I particularly wanted to think about until the book was up and running and had maybe a life of its own. Film people can be pretty good at kind of taking the joy out of everything before it's even had a chance to live its life as a book. So I'm putting that to one side until I get back home.
You've been listening to an interview with Nick Hornby, whose latest book is Slam. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.